Hello, Durham, and welcome to another Midday Special. I'm Mitchell Reed, and here is your weekly news. Now an update on COVID-19, followed by the most recent news about Toronto and Peel region entering into the grey zone of Ontario's color-coded response framework. Cheyenne Jarrett reports.
It was reported on Monday that Ontario hit its highest case count in over a month, with over 1,600 COVID cases being reported. This was followed by Ontario's Ministry of Health saying that Monday's case count was higher than expected due to a data catch-up process. Of those cases, 568 were reported in Toronto, 322 in Peel, 119 in York, and 68 new cases in Durham Region. Also on Monday, Toronto and Peel Region were finally lifted out of lockdown and are now currently in the grey zone. People living within the two regions have been limited to buying non-essential items through curbside pickup and delivery since November of last year. Moving into the gray zone means that there will be a 50% capacity limit for supermarkets, convenience stores, and pharmacies, and a 25% capacity limit for other retail stores. Being a part of the gray zone also means no indoor public events and social gatherings, unless it's with members of the same household. Durham is currently still in the red zone as of February 16th. From Pickering, reporting for Midday Special, I'm Cheyenne Jarrett.
North Durham residents can now be vaccinated starting March 15th. Kayla Jackson has the rest of the story.
The vaccine clinic will open to serve residents aged 60 to 64 from Uxbridge, Scugog, and Brock. The scheduling of appointments is still being discussed. The clinic will rotate locations of the Uxbridge Arena, Scugog Memorial Arena, and the Rick MacLeish Memorial Community Center in Cannington. The clinics are expected to run from 10:30 a.m. to 8:30 p.m. at all locations. The scheduling is based on how many vaccines the North Durham region will receive. From Simcoe County, reporting for Midday Special, I am Kayla Jackson.
The new one-shot vaccine from Johnson & Johnson is the fourth vaccine that can now be administered to Canadians. According to CTV News, Canada's Federal Health Agency has been assessing the vaccine shot since November 30th and was given the green light on February 26. The single dose has proven to be 66% effective in preventing moderate to severe cases of COVID-19 only 2 weeks after receiving the shot. The shot has been approved for only the use of adults aged 18 or older. This is still a clinical trial for ages 12 to 17. It is not all good news, however. According to Global News, Prime Minister Justin Trudeau says Canada has been warned of manufacturing problems with the Johnson & Johnson vaccine. Canada pre-ordered 10 million doses, but Trudeau says he still doesn't have a date for when Canada will receive the first deliveries. Durham schools are considering whether to include digital learning options in future years of schooling. With thousands of students currently enrolled in online learning, the Durham District School Board is asking high school students to state their preference for either virtual or in-person courses for the next year. The board has not yet made any decisions for their elementary schools. The Clarington Catholic School Board is asking families if they would opt for virtual learning next year if it were available. If the demand is high enough, they say they will proceed with a virtual school. Kawartha Pine Ridge District School Board is in its initial planning stages, but is also considering to expand e-learning for the next year. Can exotic animals contract COVID-19? Here's Nishaya Carvalho with the story.
According to San Diego Zoo, they can. Recently, 9 apes were the first animals to receive the COVID-19 vaccine. Gorillas at the zoo contracted the virus through an outbreak in January. This led to the creation of a vaccine for the animals. The vaccine was developed by Zoetis Inc., which is a U.S. firm that produces medicine for animals. It's suspected that during the outbreak, 8 gorillas caught the virus from a zookeeper who previously tested positive. Employees, however, wear masks and personal protective gear around the animals. The gorillas showed symptoms of runny nose, coughing, and lethargy, but they are recovering. There's concern about endangered animals catching the virus too. Due to this, minks and tigers at the zoo are expected to receive the vaccine as well. From Ajax, reporting for Midday Special, Nishaya Carvalho.
There's been a lot of conversation around Buckingham Palace after the tell-all interview that Prince Harry and Meghan Markle had with Oprah Winfrey. Cheyenne Jarrett reports.
Today, Prince William commented on the controversial interview that aired Sunday. A reporter asked William if the royal family is racist, which William replied, "We're very much not a racist family." He also said he hasn't spoken with Harry yet, but plans to. Prince Harry and Meghan Markle revealed the most intimate parts of their life within the royal family just this past weekend. Meghan shared her struggle with depression and thoughts of suicide due to fake news and racist attacks from the British tabloids over the last few years. The couple shared that there has been conversations within the family about how their son Archie wasn't going to be named a prince or receive security. They also recalled a conversation where a member of the royal family expressed concern over the color of their child's skin.
Those months when I was pregnant, all around this same time, so we have in tandem the conversation of he won't be given security, he's not going to be given a title, and also concerns and conversations about how dark his skin might be when he's born. Wow.
What was that conversation?
That conversation I'm never going to share.
The couple said they felt a lack of support from their family and the institution, which led to their decision to move to the U.S. Queen Elizabeth has addressed the matter and said that the family will be taking the issues raised seriously, especially the ones around racism. From Pickering, reporting for Midday Special, I'm Cheyenne Jarrett.
In November 2020, Scotland was the first country to make menstrual products free. Fast forward to a couple days ago, New Zealand has followed suit. Nishaya Carvalho reports.
Starting in June, in New Zealand, menstrual products will be free in schools. After the discovery of period poverty, schools are concerned that female students are skipping classes because they can't afford menstrual products. Prime Minister Jacinda Ardern said that young people shouldn't miss out on education because of something that is part of their normal lives. According to the Prime Minister, 1 in 12 young people were missing school because of period poverty. Ardern, along with others in the country, hope that this is one way that can address poverty and increase school attendance. Reporting for Midday Special from Ajax, Nishaya Carvalho.
Now onward to Michael Mitsinikas, who will cover sports, entertainment, and the weather.
This week in Durham consists of mostly sunny weather, with rain coming in on Thursday, and temperatures hovering around 4 to 13 degrees this week. Parts of Ontario will be hitting the 20 degrees mark, but it'll come with waves of moisture. These warmer days won't be lasting too long, however, as cold days will resume shortly after. As flooding season approaches, progress is being made to implement Ontario's flooding strategy, as well as disaster recovery systems. With this, hazardous areas will be identified much easier and will be taken care of before disaster can strike. For everyone, the pandemic has been tough, but for musicians, it has taken a large toll. Shalil Griffith-Ross reports.
As we approach the one-year mark since everything shut down due to COVID-19, we have seen retail stores, restaurants, gyms, and even studios reopen, and then close, and then reopen. However, music halls have been closed since the beginning. Musicians all over the world have had to try new things during the pandemic, while continuing to grow their skill as musicians. Pickering singer-songwriter and producer Quinny Mills has felt the effect.
So at the start of January 2020, we were actually meeting with a lot of record labels. And a week before the pandemic, we had our first meeting, or one of our first meetings with a label who was really interested in us. And they wanted to book a session. And then the pandemic happened. They kept getting pushed. And, you know, and then my band members, we couldn't get together to practice because that was no longer legal. And then we ended up just splitting up.
Zoom, Skype, Instagram Live, and other online platforms have become a sort of online stage for these musicians, since they cannot perform in person. Mills is not the biggest fan of it, though.
A big part of performing is the connection with the audience. Yeah. And not having that is just, it's not as fun, it's not fulfilling in the same way. But I have done it, yes. Sometimes it's okay. But yeah, I've done like a YouTube concert. I've done a bunch of live streams.
But he has tried to learn new things to build his skill as a musician during this rough time. He's a singer who also writes and produces his own music. So he is always trying to learn more in each of the three fields.
I've learned more about mastering. I've taken some classes on that too. I learned a lot about marketing. I've had time to write better songs. I've switched genres. Partially, I'm still doing both, but I'm working on a different genre, which I typically don't have the time to do.
Hopefully, there will be a time in the near future where artists like Quinny can perform again and have that connection with the audience. From Oshawa, Ontario, I'm Shalil Griffith-Ross, reporting for Midday Special.
This past Sunday was the NBA All-Star Game. It was much different from recent years because it took place all in one night rather than a couple of days. The event started with the Taco Bell Skills Challenge. Indiana Pacers' Domantas Sabonis won in a close-knit battle against Orlando Magic's Nikola Vucevic. He redeemed himself from last year's loss against Miami Heat's Bam Adebayo. Stephen Curry of the Golden State Warriors finished with 28 points to take home his second win in the Mountain Dew three-point contest. The AT&T Slam Dunk Contest took place during the All-Star Game's halftime show. Anfernee Simmons made history by becoming the first Portland Trailblazer to win. During the game, Team LeBron swept the board by winning all three quarters. By winning, this earned the team a total of $750,000 for its charity, the Thurgood Marshall College Fund. Giannis Antetokounmpo was the game's MVP after shooting 16 of 16 shots for 35 points. This was the first most baskets made without a miss in an All-Star Game history. Now here's Shalil Griffith-Ross with news about the Juno Award nominees.
This past week, the nominees were released for the 50th Annual Juno Awards. Toronto-born artist Weeknd is leading the pack with a total of 6 nominations, including Album of the Year for After Hours. Fellow Canadian musicians Justin Bieber and Jesse Reyes are right behind him with 5 nominations each. The legendary Celine Dion has also been nominated for Album of the Year with Courage. The show will be held on Sunday, May 16th. From Oshawa, Ontario, I'm Shalil Griffith-Ross, reporting for Midday Special.
As the hockey continues, we remember the passing of the father of one of the best, McLean Hoover reports.
Walter Gretzky, father of NHL legend Wayne Gretzky, passed away in Brantford, Ontario on March 4th. At the funeral, Wayne told stories of his father. He said Canadians should be more like his dad, proud and a true hockey dad. Walter died after sustaining an injury in his hip and passed away at the age of 82 years old.
Here is Nishaya Carvalho with some basketball news.
Toronto Raptors' Kyle Lowry is reportedly staying with the team. There were rumors he was going to be traded to the Philadelphia Sixers, his hometown. This summer, he will be a free agent. There are no predictions for what will happen then, but at least the 6-time All-Star is staying with the Raptors for a while. I will retire as a Toronto Raptor, Lowry said. From Ajax, reporting for the Midday Special, Nishaya Carvalho.
Exactly a year ago today, on March 11, 2020, the World Health Organization declared COVID-19 as a global pandemic. This was just the beginning of life as we know it today. What was supposed to be only a 2-week-long March break turned into what we have today, such as wearing masks out in public, washing hands regularly, and keeping 6 feet of social distance, as well as a long list of protocols that we must follow. Reflecting back, who knew we would be in a world where seeing our friends and family isn't allowed, and it makes us all grateful for what we have and also for what we have lost over this past year. Louis March is the founder of an organization called the Zero Gun Violence Movement. He's been a volunteer community worker and advocate for the Black community for over 30 years. Nishaya Carvalho reports more.
Louis March focuses his work on the youth and tackling issues that cause communities to be violent. In areas like Rexdale, Toronto, there's a high rate of violence, specifically shootings. Join me as I sat down with Louis to discuss gun violence.
So my first question for you is, your organization is called Zero Gun Violence Movement. So because of this, do you think that communities will end up reaching zero gun violence within them?
Zero gun violence is possible. It's not going to happen overnight, and it's not going to happen by chance. It has to happen by design, because we already have zero gun violence in the city of Toronto, but it's only in certain communities for certain people. So for example, we have zero gun violence in Rosedale. but we don't have zero gun violence in Rexdale. What's going on in Rosedale that is not going on in Rexdale? And what's going on in Rexdale that is not going on in Rosedale? And how do we ensure that those conditions that exist in Rosedale, we can transfer them to what's going on in Rexdale? You see what I'm saying? But Rosedale doesn't have poverty. They don't have unemployment. Like, the people that live in Rosedale are healthy, engaged. They have great expectations of self and of family. They don't have housing problems. They don't have drug addiction problems. So there's no violence. But in Rexdale, you have the total opposite. So if we are to have zero gun violence in Rexdale and other parts of the city, we've got to create those conditions where violence is not necessary. It's not going to happen by chance. There has to be government policy, political will to make those fundamental changes. And if that doesn't exist, then you can't have zero gun violence. Okay?
So in, for example, Rexdale, because you said it has gun violence and all that, specifically, how do you think it'll be combated?
It can be combated if there's community investments. Like I say, that poverty is one of the main drivers of violence in any society. Wherever you have violence, wherever you have, poverty, there's a likelihood that you're going to see some form of violence taking place as people compete for limited resources and to survive. The community can't do it by itself. If there's no jobs, if the education level is poor, like, you can go into a school in Rosedale and you walk through the door and you feel excited. Everything is bright. Everything is clean. Everything's in order. But you go into school in another neighborhood and it's the total opposite, right? We need to make it fair. We need to give these people a good education, good job opportunities, good health care, good housing. When they have that, they do not need to fight amongst themselves to get limited resources and to survive. So the government is a key player, but the community can also be a key player in terms of identifying what is needed and going after it. Because the government alone cannot do it.
So do you think that this is an issue that's being taken seriously within communities like Rexdale?
I would say Rexdale, Lawrence Heights, Jane and Finch, Regent Park, Parma Court, Chester Lee, Alexander Park. The residents, they want to live in peace. They want to feel safe in their communities. However, if those economic and social conditions are still bad or not up to par, violence will take place. So even though the people want it, it's difficult to achieve it without investments in these communities. The communities want to feel good. Like in certain communities in the city of Toronto, as soon as the sun sets, everybody retreats to their homes. Nobody wants to go out into the park and play. Nobody wants to go for a stroll in their neighborhood. But in another part of the city, when the sun sets, everybody comes out and they go to the playground, they go shopping, and they feel safe. Everybody wants to be like that. But you have to be laser focus in making those changes necessary to achieve it.
Let's say you are one of those people in those communities that are like trying to help out and all that. What do you do? Like, do you raise awareness? Do you talk to people about it? Do you try to reach out to the government?
That's exactly what we do. Our focus, our mandate has been about education and awareness. What's really going on? Why does somebody pick up a gun? Why does somebody join a gang? And it's social economics, because nobody is born with a gun in their hand saying, guess what? I want to be a gang leader, a drug dealer, a bank robber. Nobody says that when they're born. There's a sequence of events and conditions that create that type of mindset, right? So our thing is education and awareness. How do we explain to government what's really going on? Because sometimes I don't think they have the full picture, or I don't think they have the accurate picture. You see what I'm saying? So their decisions are not going to be good. So our thing is about education and awareness within the community and within government, then advocating for change. Advocating, can you change the way you deal with gun violence? Because they deal with government with gun violence through policing. Everything is policing. They talk about community investments, but they don't do that. But all the money that they get and spend on dealing with gun violence goes to the police. But by the time the police show up to deal with this issue, it's already too late. What are we doing to prevent? What are we doing to intervene before it gets to the point, right? You see what I'm saying? So our work is about bringing community together, talking about gun violence so that everybody's on the same page, and then advocating for change in what you're doing, currently doing, that is not working. Let's find out those things that are working and what can we do to do more of that, right? And then we also engage people that have been affected by gun violence and those people that are responsible for it. People that have done the crime, done the time, and want to make a difference. How do we get them more involved in coming up with solutions? Because I think they have a better chance of coming up with the right plan instead of the politicians or police.
Do you encounter people that aren't fully on board or just have a hard time combating the issue with you guys?
Of course. That's a good question. Because a lot of people go into these communities and claim that they come there with solutions. And they don't have the solution because they don't know the community. Because from community to community, they're different. So what might work in one community will not necessarily work in another one. Right? So Zero Gun Violence Movement never goes into a community uninvited. If you invite us into your community to help you do stuff, we will come in and help you. But we're not coming in there with solutions and saying, well, this worked in Alexander Park, so it's going to work in Regent Park. Or this worked in Lawrence Heights, so it's going to work in Jane and Finch. A lot of these communities have so many programs that have been parachuted into the community and saying, this will solve your problem. And the community says, hell no, that's not solving a problem. You never spoke to us before. So we have to be mindful of that, not going in there with a solution without engaging the community or being engaged by the community.
Was there anything else that you wanted to mention that maybe didn't come up?
What I'd like to say, right, is that in the city of Toronto, we have the resources, means, people, and skills to solve this issue of gun violence. But too many people are working in silos. That means they're working individually. The solution comes, it's like a jigsaw puzzle. Everybody's got one piece of the solution, the puzzle. But that one piece means nothing unless you bring it together and connect it with the other pieces. So the piece of policing, education, employment, housing, drug addiction, suicide, right? Lack of opportunity, youth alienation. We need to bring those people all together in one room and make the connection. And until we make that connection, we can never come up with a solution. Because they are all interlinked and they're all connected. So right now we have fragmented pieces out there working, But until we can bring those pieces together and connect them, for example, in the education system, if somebody doesn't have a proper education, how are they going to get proper employment? So we need to bring the employers to the table too and see what can we do differently. So for me, the solution lies in connecting those different pieces, not working in isolation or individually. And until we do that, we will never be able to deal with the problem of gun violence in our city.
Yeah, it's a team effort at the end of the day from like everyone to come together.
And it has to be leadership and direction. There has to be leadership from the political area, but there also has to be leadership from the community area that says we want to walk safe. We want to feel good in our community, whether it's 6 a.m. in the morning or 6 p.m., whether it's 7 a.m. or 7 p.m. We want to be able to walk safely. We want our children to be able to go to school and come home feeling safe. We want our children to be able to go to the play park, right, and have fun and come home safely. We all want that. Nobody wants to live in fear and despair, but in certain communities, that's the condition. And that's why Zero Gun Violence Movement work is so important, because we're trying to connect the dots. We're trying to connect the dots. And it is difficult because people are used to working in their silos. So our job now is to break down those silos, let them see the value of working together as a team, as you said, right, to find the right solutions.
No one is born with a gun in their hands, as March said. It's a community effort to tackle this issue, and it starts with the youth, according to him. Reporting for the Midday Special, Nishara Carvalho.
Thank you all once again for tuning into this week's edition of the Midday Special. This broadcast was brought to you by the first-year students of Durham College's Journalism Mass Media Program. Enjoy your weekend, get outside, and tune in next Thursday for our weekly broadcast.